Well, boys and girls, I'm going to present my new theme song for the Aryan Radio Network. How about this? And it's none other than Johnny Cash. Yeah.
There once was a musical troupe, a pickin' singin' folk group. They sang the mountain ballads and the folk songs of our land. They were long on musical ability, folks thought they would go far, but political incompatibility led to their downfall. Well, the one on the right was on the left, and the one in the middle was on the right, and the one on the left was in the middle, and the guy in the rear was a Methodist. This musical aggregation toured the entire nation, singing traditional ballads and the folk songs of our land. They performed with great virtuosity, and soon they were the rage, but political animosity prevailed upon the stage. Well, the one on the right was on the left, and the one in the middle was on the right, and the one on the left was in the middle, and the guy in the rear burned his driver's license. Well, the curtain had ascended, a hush fell on the crowd, as thousands there were gathered to hear the folk songs of our land. But they took their politics seriously, and that night at the concert hall, as the audience watched deliriously, they had a free-for-all. Well, the one on the right was on the bottom, and the one in the middle was on the top, and the one on the left had a broken arm, and the guy on his rear said, oh dear. Now this should be a lesson. If you plan to start a folk group, don't go mixing politics with the folk songs of our land. Just work on harmony and diction, play your banjo well, and if you have political conviction, keep them to yourself. Now the one on the left works in a bank, and the one in the middle drives a truck. The one on the right's an all-night DJ, and the guy in the rear got drafted.
Well, boys and girls, how'd you like that one? Ha, ha, ha. That reminds me. You see, that's what we like about white chaos. Yeah. When you shake the bush, things start to happen. And that's why, let me give you the address. We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Keep your donations coming, and we'll keep the propaganda going. Yeah. That's why we love the white Russians. Whether they did it or whether they didn't do it, they have spread chaos, fear, and anxiety in the... What did Bob Miles call it? La Cesspool Grande. Yeah, I love it. Thank you, white hackers from over there in cold old Russia. I don't think it's any colder than here this morning. It's 0 degrees. My goodness, my dogs didn't even want to go out to pee. Man, I'll tell you, it's something else. I got a couple of these made out of like stone, but concrete or whatever, dogs out in my patio. And hell, I walked out there this morning, I thought they were real dogs that froze to death. Yeah, white chaos is going forward like mad. All the talk shows are going crazy. The Russians are coming. It's about as funny as that movie, The Russians Are Coming. Remember that? That's a funny-ass movie. I'm sure most of the Russians are laughing their ass off, and the Europeans are sitting there scratching their head. What the hell? Those guys have gone totally mad over there in the USA. Why is everybody so worried about their Facebook and their emails and stuff? I don't really care. I want to explain something to you, boys and girls. When I was a little kid, the first telephone we had in our house right out of the box was a crank phone. And it hung up on the wall, and you had about 10 other people, maybe 15, on your line. And each one of you had a different ring, you know, like two rings and a short ring and a long ring and like that. When you wanted to call out. Well, anyhow, anybody could pick up the phone and listen. So if you had 15 people on your line, there's 15 people could be listening to what you're saying. And you could tell, however, though, when they picked up, there was a click in the phone. But that's the way email is. And people just haven't caught on to that yet. Somebody can get to it no matter where it's at. Now, me, I don't plan criminal things on my email. I don't do all the things that people get in trouble for. And I'm not having extramarital relations and all that on the telephone. So don't bother me. I've been hacked before, and I wouldn't say anything on the telephone. I wouldn't say it on the village square. That's right. I do that. That's why I don't get invited to parties, because I just say it the way it is, the way I feel like saying it. People don't like it, they can kiss my white ass. So I don't worry about that email shit, you know. Well, anyhow, congratulations to my buddies over in Russia, because they're really creating white chaos, and we need all the help we can get. You know, we can't get it from the stupid right wing. You know, they wouldn't understand me saying this about the Russians. They wouldn't understand at all. Oh, that Metzger, he's a commie. I always knew he was a commie, son of a bitch. Yeah, right. Well, they don't even have the message yet that Russia's not communist anymore. Most of the worst parts of communism we've adopted in this country. Yeah, they got rid of it, and we bought it in here. I heard a guy on talk radio this morning saying, well, if you don't believe it's true about the Russians getting into doing this stuff, you read the New York Times today. There's an excellent article explaining the whole thing. Right. I don't even believe the page numbers on the New York Times. I never read it. Never read it. If you want to have fun and laugh, you read it. And of course, the Washington Post is even worse. I sometimes try to send them one of these comments when they do an article, but most of the time it doesn't get through. Because the Washington Post is, well, hell, I have to listen to Russian news to get anything halfway straight, you know. Russia TV, I watch it all the time. Some of the best commentary and articles that you can get are on Russia TV. So I guess I is a newbie communist. One thing for sure, I ain't a Democrat, and I ain't a and I ain't a Republican. And I think democracy is a bunch of bullshit. It always has been. They call it democracy. This is no more a democracy than the man in the moon. And it was supposed to be a republic, but we lost that about the time of the Civil War. That was when we changed to empire. We became empire. And nobody asks you anything when they decide to do something. They say, oh, well, your congressman's supposed to protect you. Ha, bullshit. He's sold out before he can get out of the state. The senator, he's all sold out and booked up before he can get out of the state. So the idea of your representative government is a bunch of crock of shit. And anybody with a real brain knows that. And anybody, you see, 45 or 49% of the eligible voters didn't vote. Well, that happens every time. So it's almost a majority of people that could vote don't vote. So they're voting no confidence. Like, when I don't vote, I'm voting no confidence. But they don't want to look at that. You know, when they tried to get no confidence on the ballot out in California, I think it was, years ago, they kicked it out because, hell, they didn't want people saying, well, there's no confidence. Well, like I think the Brits have that no confidence clause. I'm sure the French do. So the hell with it, you know. People who are voting at this late date are the most screwed up, misled, stupid. You can't fix stupid people in the country. But people who don't vote out of political beliefs are the smart ones. Yeah. Of course, there's a lot of people who don't vote just because they're lazy. I'm not including those people into it. But it's not worth the gasoline it takes you in your car to get down to the polling booth. Because once they figured out this party system, which incidentally George Washington was against it, the so-called father of the nation. Once they figured that out, well, it was easy for the Jew boys or liberal boys or whatever boys, the rats, to get a hold of the political parties and ensure that you would never solve a problem. It was easy once they got political parties, and especially a two-party system where they will fight like hell to keep any other entity from getting on the ballot. I mean, look at the Libertarians and the Green Party and all that. They have to fight their ass off to get on a ballot, you know, because all the rules and regulations in the states are set up to keep minor parties out. So you'll always have this Republican-Democrat con game, you know. You want a liberal? Oh, we'll give you a liberal. You want a so-called conservative? We'll give you a conservative. We'll give you whatever you want, but we'll control the show because we're the ruling class, stupid. Let me remind you about this conservative game. Conservative, yeah. They're not conserving anything for the white race. Do you think that they were conserving anything for the white? What has, in the last 50 years, maybe more, what has the government done to conserve the white race or the best interests of the white race? They've done just the opposite. They don't give a shit about the best interests of the white race. They're just concerned about making lots of money, having the power, going to war, building a lot of weapons, dropping atomic bombs if they get a chance and like that. That's what they're interested in. Told this story before when I won the Democratic nomination for U.S. Congress in the 43rd Congressional District back in 1980. I had a friend up in San Francisco, and he wanted me to meet some politicians. They wanted to talk to me, so they took me up to a big-ass ranch up in along the coast. And we sit around a big table. We had political people there. We had sheriff of the county was there. Ex-cabinet member was there. And they said, Tom, you know, we like your politics, but you got to go with us. If you come up with us in the Republican Party, I think we can assure you a pretty good career. But you're going to have to go with the Ronald Reagan form of government. And I never supported Ronald Reagan. I didn't even support him for governor. Early on, way early, I had supported him. I worked in his headquarters in Manhattan Beach. But I found out what he was like because I knew a lot of people in Hollywood that worked on the scene, on the sets, on the movies. And they knew what a cowardly bastard he was and how he wouldn't follow orders of the directors properly, didn't have enough brains to stand on the X when they told him to. So I learned about him from people who worked with him for years. And So I said, no, I'm not going to go. I'm going to go for the working man, the blue-collar man. He's a phony. He's talking about blue-collar, but he's bullshitting you. I won't go that way. And so that was the end of that. And the same offer was made by the Democrats from Pat Brown, ex-governor, when he told me, Tom, you could have a great career in politics if you just get away from this KKK thing. And at the time, I felt that that was the best way to go, and I said, no, I'm not going to do that, Mr. Pat Brown. I appreciate your concern. And that was that. And that was the end of Terrible Tommy's political career. I wouldn't stand on the X like Ronald Reagan did. And if you're going to be successful in politics, you got to learn to stand on the X. The Democrats are just as funny. Actually, they're more funny than the Republicans. Yeah. Yeah, they were told they were being hacked by the FBI. And it took them from September to April to finally own up to it and figure it out. And everybody was being hacked. And hacking like that is great because all the what they really say behind the scenes come out. You know, they say they love the Negroes, but it don't sound like they love the Negroes when they talk in their private emails. They just screw up all the time, and the Democrat Party was made a total joke, and it took our white Russian friends, maybe, I don't know for sure, but maybe it took them to put her into place, to put the Clintons into place. Now we've got a Ronald McDonald, that who the hell knows what he's going to do, but we know one thing, he's going to keep chaos going, man. It may not be white chaos, but it's going to be chaos. So this is going to be funnier than it's going to be very funny to watch this stuff, because almost everything he's going to do that drives the other side crazy, I love, just because it's chaos. And that's the factor that we want to follow. I don't expect the Jewish left or the Jewish right or even the racial right to follow the best ideas. They're gonna fart around and get their feet all stuck up with Donald Trump, and they should be backing away already or never even got on board because he's got Jews all around. They're screaming about Jews all the time. And here's Ronald McDonald. He's even got him in his family. Now, if the right-wingers and the Dukeites had any brains, rather than going for short-run publicity, they'd have backed out of this thing a long time ago. But it should, if there's any right-wingers out there who have any right-wing racists out there who have any brains, they should have backed away from Trump early on. Going to be too late now, boys. Going to be too late. Of course, most of the even right-wing racists are so stupid, they're going to cling to Donald Trump. And just like they always do, they get some guy that throws them a bone that runs for president, and they think, here he comes. This guy's going to save the white race. This guy's going to be like Adolf Hitler. And they never are they? Well, that's showbiz. Can you believe those stupid bastards in the Democrat National Committee went from September to April after being warned of hacking? They were being hacked before they finally woke up. And you want to put Hillary as president? Oh boy, that's worse than Benghazi. You realize the Democratic National Headquarters in New York City was only few blocks walking distance from the FBI. The FBI could have walked over to the Democratic National Committee and told them, hey, boss, you're being hacked. You better do something. Okay, we'll do it next spring in April. Well, wait a minute. This is September. Well, we got a lot of work to do. We don't have time to worry about hacking. Do you realize what it would be like if they allowed us, people who supported the race and would talk openly about racial issues, on major TV? I mean, can you imagine? I'm telling you, man, that's why they keep legitimate races off TV. Once in a while, they'll pick up on one like Dookie and this new guy, and they'll use them. And if they ever want to get rid of them, it's very easy. If the ADL ever released the files on at least one of these birds, of which I am had privy to the file, that wouldn't last long, I'll tell you. So, oh, yes. Sometimes things smell pretty badly. Just think, if we'd have had people like Revelo P. Oliver, people like that on TV every day, on the radio every day, this thing would turn around pretty fast, at least for white people, or at least white people that had any brains. But they don't allow anybody like that on TV. No. Why? Why is that? Because race is the most important thing in our society, period. And they don't want anybody putting our arguments out. You're lucky, even if they get the books on race are still allowed. They're not in the library, that's for sure. Almost nothing. They put Mein Kampf in there because they've so battered old Uncle Adolf that they feel they're safe now to put out. There was a lot of stuff in Mein Kampf that was correct, just like there's stuff in the Bible is correct, but that don't make the book correct. Have you noticed one overriding factor in world politics? That all these Western leaders, all these presidents and premiers that went along with regime change, they wanted regime change in all these countries in North Africa. Well, as last I looked, they all bit the dust. They're all out of power, all of them. But Assad, the last one of their big targets, he's still in power. All these assholes that wanted to get rid of Assad are out of power, but he's still there. And it looks like he's going to pick up the marbles in the end. Well, here we go. We got a billionaire oil man now going to head up the State Department. Watch out, all you little countries out there. He's going to clean you out good, like he's been cleaning you out. Yeah. Developing the oil and all that kind of stuff in all these little countries. That's fine, but the people in little countries didn't get shit back. Just some big Amos and Andy guy at the top raking in all the money and spending it on arms that the United States military-industrial complex pushes on these stupid niggers over there in Africa. Oh, you got to have tanks, you got to have planes, you got to have this and that, which they don't have to have. Well, they do, because we'll cause somebody to be your enemy. Yeah. You will promote somebody to rise up and be your enemy, and you'll have a civil war, and you're going to have these weapons, and you'll have to pay for those weapons with oil. Jeez. And now the top guy, the top oil man in the world probably is going to be the head of the State Department, Secretary of State. And the worst area of government is the State Department. If you got a department to try to get rid of, that's the one to try to get rid of. Well, I'm disappointed with my Russian TV a little bit because Max Kaiser is one of my favorites, had on his show Alex Jones. I couldn't believe it, but there he was, Alex Jones, and he was being treated really nice. This is a real right-wing buffoon, and of course he's, even the clock's right once a day or twice a day, so obviously not everything he says is false, but mostly exaggerated, and he reminds me of a lot of other right-wingers in the past over the years since I've been involved, that people get all gaga over, but he's making a lot of money, I'll say that, and but I can't stand to watch him, and I can't stand to listen to him. So, Max, straighten up. Fly right. course, the right wingers out there, they just love Alex Jones, every crazy thing he comes up with. And of course, not everything he says is wrong, like I said, but he interspaces it with a bunch of malarkey, and he comes off like a damn carnival barker. And you better read everything. If he puts out something, you better study, look into it very carefully before you digest it. Even the right wing now talks about McCarthyism. Well, there were excesses that McCarthy was involved in. However, for all the people that bashed Joe McCarthy, you haven't done your homework, because after the Russian Soviet Union fell, they got into the archives of the KGB and so forth, and they found that many of the things that Joe McCarthy was saying about communists and Marxists in our government were very, very true. But you don't hear that. You just hear even right-wing conservatives who should know better bashing Joe McCarthy. Well, you can criticize Joe McCarthy for maybe going too far, but you can't criticize him for being wrong about communists in the government, because they were there and the KGB files show they were there. That just shows you how fake the right wing is. Just like they were fake on the China situation. It was the Republicans and the National Commerce people that shipped the jobs to China, or got it going to where people were moving their plants out of the country to Red China. And those Richard Nixon was the guy who started it all. Like I've told you before, he was on the cover of Life Look magazine over there in the Great Hall of the Commies, starting this whole thing of moving all our manufacturing out of the country. The Republicans started it. Again, conservatives are funny as hell. Now the same conservatives are saying, oh, that's horrible. We've got to bring them back. We've got to bring them back. They don't talk about the Republicans are the ones that started the program to put them over there. Even the Democrats weren't into it that much, which proves that Americans and white Americans are the worst at history. They don't study history. They just listen to some bullshit right-winger, conservative, or whatever you want to call them, giving them the history they want them to think. But nobody talks about that. Hey, wasn't that son of a bitch Nixon that went over there and opened up trade with China? Wasn't that? Remember when Willie's Jeep went over there? They got their clock clean, too, and they came back here. They tried to sell an American-style Jeep in China. It cost too much money because it was a good machine. Then the Chinese came out with an imitation Jeep. It was the lousiest Jeep ever built. It wouldn't even have Jeep on it, have the name on it. So they had to go back to dealing with Detroit. Well, we've got a little thing here from the, I guess they're liberal journalists. But a lot of the stuff they say is true, and to throw it all out with the bathwater is a mistake. Of course, that's done all the time, you know. The rise of the white racial nationalism. While there were many reasons for Donald Trump's surprise victory, a particularly ugly one was his success in touching the raw nerve of white racial animosities. There's little doubt that white racism played a role in the U.S. presidential election of 2016. It sure did. It sure did. As Zach Beauchamp demonstrates in a November 10th article at the Vox.com, enthusiastic support for Donald Trump, 10 on the scale of 10, among white voters in mostly white geographic areas was about 25%. However, in areas of growing ethnic and racial diversity, the percentage of all-in-for-Trump support goes way up. How about that? Beauchamp, in other words, in more diversified areas, the whites were obviously more racist. Of course, what have we been telling them for years? They don't want to admit it. All white areas are the worst areas to talk racism because they don't feel threatened as much. Beauchamp quotes the research of the University of London scholar Eric Kaufman, who surveyed Trump's white supporters. Kaufman's original findings are reported in the policy blog of the London School of Economics. There's a real conservative place, at least on money they are. One result was that in areas that had experienced a 30% rise in mestizo population, the number of whites who enthusiastically supported Trump rose to 70%. How about that? Trump's own racism had been on public display during his entire campaign and often, although erroneously, merged the phenomenon of immigration and violence. Here he found a ready and responsive audience. Yeah, he played around with the race issue. Racism for the rich is what he played around with while using the working class to get him there. Beauchamp goes on to demonstrate that white supporters of Donald Trump saw immigration and terrorism as the country's major problems. Moreover, they connected these two issues to their fear of the country's growing race mixing they call diversity. Of course, economic woes were also a concern, but they too were exacerbated by fear of the fact that the country was under the leadership of a black man, a Negro, Barack Obama. Then, to broaden their outlook of the racist and sectarian impact on politics, both Beauchamp and Kaufman pointed out that the racist underpinnings of Trump's electoral success parallels the Brexit voting patterns in the United Kingdom in June 2016. There, too, ethnocentric racial anxiety over a changing society appears to have spurred on the vote to leave the European Union. Well, it's pretty easy to understand. Brexit is not the only telling parallel to the Trump-style popular racist appeal. Indeed, you are looking for someone whose bigoted outlook and unethical political practice comes close to Donald Trump's. You can tell where this guy's coming from. You can go to Israel and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The nitwit school, stood for re-election in March 2015. His main opponent was the Labour Party leader Isaac Herzog. During the election campaign, one of Herzog's consultants was the American political advisor Paul Begella, a longtime political ally of the Clintons. Soon after Netanyahu's re-election, Begella explained how Netanyahu had won. He won because of race. That was a quote. In the U.S., you could never get away with those kind of racist appeals, but man, did it work in Israel. Unquote. He went on, quote, I have never seen anything like Bibi's furious surge to the right in the last 4 days of the campaign. He had robocalls calling the U.S. President Hussein Obama and Muslim. He had ads saying the Arabs will vote in droves. He accused Herzog of wanting to divide Jerusalem. In fact, that man did it. This racist approach worked. In Israel, should have been no surprise. A year later, March 2016, the Pew Research Center survey of Israel society reported that nearly half of the Jews in the country, 48%, say they supported ethnic cleansing of Arabs, unquote. The Israeli Prime Minister and his fellow travelers certainly knew this ahead of the Pew report. As it turned out, Nitwit's appeal to fear of the Arabs was roughly equivalent to Trump's appeal to fear of immigrants in the United States. Bengala readily recognized the importance of the racist factor in Netanyahu's success. Where he was wrong was to link that in the U.S. you could never get away with those kind of racist appeals, unquote. It turned out that many white U.S. voters were as receptive to such a race-based fear campaign as were the Israeli Jews. As with Netanyahu, racism helped Trump win. Of course, because race is a major factor. Taking a broader view, we can see that the racism manifested itself in Israel and the United States is part of a general phenomenon of reactionary populism spreading throughout the West. Is that sort of like racial national socialism? I'm not going to say that. This fact has been recognized by the venerable and progressive Israeli commentator Yuri Avniri. In a recent column entitled The Call of the Nation, Avniri observes a dark wave submerging democracies all over the Western world. Fascism and populism are gaining ground all around, unquote. Wow. Well, that's because democracy, even when it's not democracy, doesn't work. And doing so in the name of old-fashioned ethnocentric racial nationalism. After all, for most people, the need to belong to a nation is a profound psychological need. Yeah, it's basically tribalism. People create a national culture, often speak a national language. People are ready to die for their nation, unquote. Well, that makes sense. In the end, Avniri concluded that what we are witnessing now is a rebellion of nationalism against the trend towards a globalist world. Well, I would like to see the globalist world based on race, for the white race. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with a globalist idea if it's white. The globalist trend Avniri speaks of shows its disruptive potential soon after World War II. It was then there began a large-scale movement of peoples from poorer countries and regions into richer ones. Yeah, that makes sense for them. This was often supported by Western elites because of pressing, if not temporary, post-war labor needs. This was later needs. How about that? When they say Western elites, that's the industrial ruling class that wanted to drive down labor costs. The more the non-whites they bring into the country, the more they can depress wages for white people. This was later joined by the creation of the larger transnational economic units, same stuff, which saw the movement of not people but jobs flowing from richer to poorer countries and regions. The motives there was a search for cheap labor markets, of course. First they screw the whites, and then they go back and screw the non-whites. But equal opportunity bastards. For the average Western citizen, it was all very confusing and frightening. Almost simultaneously, they saw what appeared to be alien groups invading their local environments, while a bit later their traditional job base was swept away to some foreign land. Well, that's definitely true, man. It was inevitable that all this would sooner or later cause a backlash, or a white lash, in the West. This white lash would merge racism and economics. Well, they're inseparable, suggesting to many that economics rivalry was another form of racial competition. Well, if the shoe fits, wear it. The backlash also, as Avniri suggests, released a wave of nationalist populism. That's similar to the original national socialism. The socialists and the populists got along fine in early 20th century. With its strong ethnocentric or racial undertones, While this movement will create a context of racist and tribalistic venting, yeah, it will not be able to do more than momentarily slow economic globalization. Well, it could bring it to a stop if it really wanted to. Or if it really wanted to get to work and do it. That will continue as long as capitalism rules our commercial, fiscal, and industrial lives. I agree with that. So economically, it is one world in the long run. Well, that can be changed. Seeing these two, racist nationalism and economic globalism, in juxtaposed is important. Racist nationalism, as it now expresses itself in the U.S., Israel, United Kingdom, and European continent, has the ability to make a profound mess of local politics? No, I think it'll be great. It can and no doubt will undermine democratic virtues, bullshit, such as civil and human rights. Well, when it comes to food and housing, that comes first, not civil and human rights. So-called rights. What the hell is a right? Explain to me a right. Go to court and see if you get your rights. It will probably undermine the rule of law itself. Yeah. Not natural law. It'll be enforced. Yet the very thing it fears the most, the one world economic process, will certainly go up on apace. Yeah, the big boys at the top, they'll figure some way around it, like they did in Germany. And because of the weakening of political and legal rights at the hands of racist and authoritarian governments, in the long run, we will all end up more exposed to economic exploitation than we ought to be. No, not anymore. And maybe a lot less. That will prove to be a very high price for whatever emotional satisfaction your stalwart white nationalist may now feel. Well, what we're talking about is here, Trump is not what I would call a true white nationalist. He is a true white capitalist with some racism tacked on for the rich, not for you working class. He don't give a shit about your relationship to non-whites. Anyhow, that's the end of that, and it's that was by Lawrence Davidson. He's a history professor at Westchester University in Pennsylvania. That was pretty interesting, especially about Israel. They're very racist over there, because I was over there last year. They got a giant prison on the southern border of Israel full of blacks that they pick up trying to come into Israel. They're far more racist about the blacks over there as a national policy, although they don't talk about it much, than we are here. And there's actually a totally racist political party over there. They don't talk about that party either, but they do demonstrate in the streets. So that may confuse a few racists that you have racist comrades in Israel. Wait a minute, now what am I going to do? Well, let's end the show with a little more reading from State Secrets, from that international anti-communist organization that used to operate out of Guadalajara, Mexico. We had some joint meetings with those people, but the organization was destroyed by one General Singlob. You remember, I think he was in Korea, and he was upset because they were giving the Jews hell. And so he single-handedly had a lot of power, General Singlob, destroyed this great organization. This is from the chapter on the Nuremberg trials. They penetrated into Silesia and reached the middle bank of the Oder at Custrin and Frankfurt. The Wehrmacht was unable to fulfill its natural mission of protecting our people in the East and their territory. Terrified masses fled towards the West. They knew what the Soviet invasion meant. In October 1944, having captured Gold Op and several villages on the frontier of eastern Prussia, they massacred their inhabitants with unheard of cruelty and appealed to the Red Army by the Jewish writers Ilya Ehrenberg made it quite clear. I think I read this before. Kill, kill, kill. In the German race there is nothing but evil. Not one among the living, not one among the yet born, but is evil. Follow the precepts of Comrade Stalin. Stamp out the fascist beast once and for all in its lair. Use force, break the racial pride of the Germanic women. Take them as your lawful booty. Kill, as you storm onwards, kill, you gallant soldiers of the Red Army. And that was a peace-loving Jewess. In my opinion, continues Dönitz, the first duty befell what remained of our armed forces was to save those unfortunate peoples. Well, you'd have saved them a lot better if you hadn't gotten a war in the first place and not invaded Russia. If, to our great sorrow, we were unable to defend their lands, and the very least we could do was to save their lives. If only for this reason, it is indispensable to pursue the struggle on the Eastern Front. There's another factor to consider. At the behest of the Allies, the war could only be terminated by our unconditional surrender. As far as our troops were concerned, the signature of the capitulation would immediately arrest their movements. They would have to lay down their arms and hand themselves over, whatever they might be. If we had capitulated in the winter of 44 and 45, 3.5 million soldiers who were still very far from the Anglo-American front would have been taken prisoner by the Russians. With the best will in the world, the latter would have been incapable of looking after them, feeding them, and sheltering them. Our men would have had to camp out in the open and in the cold, and in consequence there would certainly have been appalling mortality. What happened in May, at a much more favorable time, is proof of this. Even in the West, the English and the Americans were unable to provide enough food for the prisoners, large numbers of whom died. Well, they had enough food. Eisenhower wouldn't break it out of the warehouses and give it to them. In consequence, the termination of the war by unconditional surrender during the winter of 44-45 would have entailed the death of millions of soldiers and civilians. None of those who then held a responsible position in the Wehrmacht could urge this course of action. None of the unfortunate refugees in the East would have agreed to being handed over to the Russians in this way. No soldier wanted to endure Soviet captivity. Well, unfortunately, boys and girls, German military and Italians and the other people who invaded Russia killed 20 million people. That makes people pissed off. So I know the right wing likes to say the Germans were perfect and they did it. Everything was wonderful because they were fighting communism. But they really were fighting the Russian people and they killed millions. So we have to look at it from both sides. The troops probably could not have obeyed the order to stop where they were and hand themselves in. No commander could have signed the capitulation at this period without knowing that it would not be respected, and also that it, by so doing, he would be consigning a large number of people to their destruction. No one in conscience could take such a decision. Quote, painful though it was to have to continue the struggle and sacrifice men on land and on sea and accept the civilian losses caused by the bombing raids, nevertheless, it had to be done because these sacrifices would in the end prove to be less than those which a premature surrender of the territories of the East would have entailed. But the American government and Roosevelt and Churchill didn't care. In the first days of the May, Admiral Dönitz began direct negotiations with Field Marshal Montgomery with a view to concluding a partial German capitulation limited to the English sector on the Western Front and independently of the Russian Front. Montgomery laid down certain conditions before it could be accepted. On 4 May, I gave Freidberg full powers to accept Montgomery's demands. He left by aeroplane for the British headquarters with instructions to continue after the convention had been signed to Reims, where General Eisenhower was stationed, in order to offer a similar partial capitulation to the Americans. After his departure, we felt a burden had been taken off our shoulders. We had just taken the first step towards surrender in the West without having to agree to surrender our soldiers and civilians to the Russians. This had other consequences. Montgomery demanded the cessation of hostilities on the sea and the surrender of ships which were in the waters of Holland, Northwest Germany, Schleswig-Holstein, and Denmark. Going one step further ahead, at midday on the 4th of May, I ordered our submarines throughout the world to cease hostilities. This was part of my intention to cease hostilities against the West at the earliest possible moment. In the evening, Freidberg announced that he had signed the capitulation with Montgomery and that he was leaving to see Eisenhower. The capitulation took effect from 8 o'clock on the morning of the 5th of May. On the morning of the 6th of May, General Kinzel, who had accompanied Freidberg, arrived in Meerwijk, having been sent by Freidberg to inform me of the state of negotiations with Eisenhower. Well, I screwed up there. I started reading what I'd already read to you before. I'd covered up the rest of the pages on my desk. I had to look all over for them. Anyhow, here we go. The latter, he told me, in contrast with Montgomery, refused to accept a partial capitulation under any conditions. We had to surrender now, unconditionally, and on every front, including the Russian front. The troops were to lay down their arms wherever they might be, or to be taken prisoner. The high command of the Wehrmacht would be responsible for seeing that this surrender was carried out, and the order extended to all ships of war and commerce. Quote, "We were afraid that Eisenhower might adopt this attitude. In my speech on the wireless on the 1st of May, I had said, as from this moment the British and Americans are no longer fighting for their own countries, but for the extension of Bolshevism in Europe. An American station situated at Eisenhower's general headquarters had replied that this was a typical and well-known trick of the Nazis in an endeavor to create a split between Eisenhower and the Russian allies. However, the latest operations which he had ordered showed that he was not in the least aware of the turn taken by the world of politics at the moment. After his troops had crossed the Rhine at Remagen, America had achieved her strategic objective of conquering Germany. From this moment, the paramount objective should have become political, namely the occupation of the largest possible area of Germany before the arrival of the Russians. Thus, it would have been judicious for the American commander to have pushed rapidly east in order to be first to seize Berlin. But Eisenhower did not do this. He kept to military plan, which had been drawn up for the destruction of Germany and its occupation in collaboration with the Red Army, and so he stopped at the Elbe. Thus the Russians were able to take Berlin and conquer whatever they could of eastern Germany. Perhaps this policy had been dictated by Washington, but he did not understand how radically the world situation was to be transformed from this moment. Well, I do. I think Eisenhower was part of the bad shit all along. Accordingly, I consider that this decision by the Americans was wrong, and I have not changed my opinion today. after the Potsdam Conference, an American colonel told Count Schwerin Kroska that it was a matter of indifference to him whether the whole of Germany was occupied by the Russians, and this indeed was the attitude of all American opinion. If I had accepted the conditions brought back by General Kinzel on the morning of the 6th of May, I would have had to hand over our armies in the east to the Russians immediately. I could not accept this. The troops would not have obeyed the order. A mad rout towards the west would have resulted. Thus Eisenhower's conditions were unacceptable, and all I could do was to try to convince him that I could not possibly allow our soldiers and civilians to fall into the hands of the Soviets, and accordingly I had to be content with offering a partial capitulation. I summoned Jodl to send him to Freiburg's help with new instructions. I wrote out a note to Jodl giving him full power to sign a general capitulation on all fronts, but he was only to use it if he was unable to obtain the first objective, which was a partial capitulation, and then only after he had informed me of the conditions and received my express agreement by cable. On 6 May, he flew to Reims, France. On the night of the 7th to the 7th of May, I received the following message from him. General Eisenhower insists that we must sign now today, otherwise the Allied lines will be closed against even individual persons who seek to hand themselves over, and all negotiations will be broken off. Thanks, Ike. You know, when I was a kid in junior high, I remember being involved in the I Like Ike Club. They handed us all badges and everything and said we were in the I Like Ike Club. Boy, I regret the day I did that. As I see it, either there is chaos or we sign. Confirm immediately by wireless that I have in fact got full powers to sign the capitulation. Then it can be have an effect. Hostilities will end on 9th May at 0 hours, German summertime. Eisenhower, we learned, had again refused any partial capitulation and category rejected the two proposals. He told Jodl that he would fire on any German soldier, even unarmed, who approached the American lines in order to surrender himself. However, owing, it would seem, to the more understanding attitude of General Bedell Smith, his chief of staff, and to Jodl's statement that in the present condition of our communications, we would need at least 2 days to get the capitulation order transmitted to all the troops, he finally agreed to a delay of 48 hours on the condition that we signed on the spot. Thus, I had to take an immediate decision. According to the telegram, if we signed on the 7th, the troops would still be able to move until 0 hours on the 9th. I was afraid that this delay would not suffice to save either all soldiers or all civilians. On the other hand, Jodl had succeeded in obtaining it, and it would nevertheless allow a considerable number of people to regain security of the West. I would not have gained any advantage by refusing Eisenhower's demand, which would only have produced the chaos which we feared and the immense and useless loss of life. Consequently, at 1 o'clock in the morning, I telegraphed to Jodl, and he was qualified to sign the general capitulation on this basis, which he did at Reims at 2:41 a.m. On May 8th, obviously at the wish of the Russians, this formality was repeated at the headquarters of Marshal Zhukov, the Soviet commander-in-chief at Berlin, Karlshorst. Marshal Keitel, General Stumpf, and Admiral Freyberg signed for the three armed forces. The Western Allies and the Soviets had asked for full powers, which I had expanded, enabling them to carry out this gesture. and these powers were very carefully verified before the ceremony. The fate of the soldiers in the East and of the refugees was decided that day. The vast majority of the men in the Southern armies under General Rendulic succeeded in crossing the American demarcation lines. Those under General Luer in the Southeastern group had less luck. On the 9th of May, a good number of them were still several days' march away. Luer endeavored by negotiators with the Yugoslavs to lessen the severity of their lot in every possible way, but several tens of thousands nevertheless died in the Yugoslav camps. In the north, the American General Carbon, who had occupied part of Mecklenburg on the 2nd of May with his airborne division and who was working in the British advance on Lübeck, since his division was part of the British Army, allowed the remains of the Vistula Army to cross behind his lines. But owing to delays, numbers of columns of refugees fell into the hands of the Russians, who were following close behind. On the center front, the 12th Army, commanded by General Wink, had been ordered to free Berlin by attacking towards the east. Wink succeeded in reaching the region of Potsdam, and thereby opened the road to the west to the defenders of this town and to the 9th Army, who brought with them a mass of refugees. But the civilians were not allowed to cross the Elbe. Wink's army did everything in its power to smuggle over the largest possible number of refugees with them, unknown to the Americans. But this inhumane order condemned a large number of those unfortunates, some of whom had been fleeing for weeks to the mercy of the Soviets. The soldiers of Schnorr's army met an even more deplorable fate. The vast majority of them reached the American lines, but they were not allowed to cross them. They were even fired upon in order to keep them back. After they had so valiantly accomplished their duty, those who did not die of hunger or cold had to endure the rigors of Russian captivity for many long years. Obviously, Eisenhower was to write this in his memoirs. The Germans sought to gain time in order to bring back into and behind our lines a maximum number of women or men who were still fighting in the East. I began to have had enough. I ordered B.L. Smith to tell Jodl that if he did not immediately stop dragging out the negotiations, we would go so far as to use force in order to prevent the refugees crossing. Well, this shows you what a bastard Eisenhower was. He knew they were trying to save these refugees, thousands and thousands of them, and he committed them to be captured by the Soviets, and many of them were taken up to Siberia and so forth, to the labor camps. Well, that's about all I can handle for today. Makes me so sick to read this shit and to think what a hero we made out of Eisenhower and made him our president. The most anti-white, anti-human guys in history become our presidents and leaders in other countries too. That's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow on Thursday, 14:05.